Blog Talk Radio.
You know, in Provincetown, it's hard to draw a crowd. You know, you're competing with Margaret Cho and Tate Clinton and some guy dressed up like Cher on a scooter or something like that, you know. So I was with a couple of other lesbian comics. We called ourselves Famous Lesbian Comedy Roadshow, Famous Lesbians Not Included. And we ran around giving out free chocolates to everyone and trying to get them to come to our comedy show. That was somewhat successful, but then they said, oh, what we need to do is go put on our costumes. I wasn't aware that we travel with costumes, right? They go up to the room, one comes back with dressed up like Xena. Another person comes dressed like Wonder Woman.
Woo!
Do you guys travel with Xena and Wonder Woman costumes? You do. Okay, I didn't know. It wasn't in the book. See, I didn't know about the tattoo. I didn't. So I was like, okay, well, what will I wear? So I just decided on a t-shirt and a utility belt. That's as far as I could go, you know. So we're like walking around. And, you know, sometimes the straight people in Provincetown, they get a little bit of information, and they think they know everything. Because as we're walking down the road, me, Xena, and Wonder Woman, a whole group of straight people. That's the universal sign for straight people across the world. That would be a great start of a joke, right? All these straight people across the road. To get away from gay people in Provincetown. So they look at us, and the one, obviously the patriarchy, and he's stroking his chin, and he's like, See those two? Those are men. Another guy looks at him and looks at me and he goes, no, that's a college drag queen too. Yes, I'm a drag queen. I am the world's worst drag queen. Queen that can't possibly be bothered to make myself in any way appear stereotypically female.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Fire Talk Productions. This is Fire Talk, and I am your host, Russ Letica. Today, joining me on the panel would be Nell Cole, the producer of our show, along with David Little Eagle. We have a pretty good show for you today. It's on a lighter subject than we usually speak on. Today we have with us Kelly Durham. She has a remarkable story. Kelly was actually a nun at one time. She's a comedian. She's a writer. She's produced a couple, at least one CD that I'm aware of here in her bio. Kelly's comedy is like, it's a gentle, edgy comedy, and she's not afraid to take her critical storytelling style into an area where even slam poetry does not dare to trend. Between her life with a torn-up birth certificate, the pearls of responding to an extreme sarcasm coming from a dying lover, once again, you know, that is life, and Kelly has taken her life, and she's turned it around to make something positive of it, and that's what we always talk about here on the show, becoming positive in your life. With that said, I'd like to welcome the panel now. David, welcome to Fire Talk today.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you very much.
Great. With that, let's get Kelly right on the line because I'm really interested in talking with Kelly. Kelly comes from a very colorful background that intrigues me, and I'd like to speak more on her. So, Kelly, welcome to Fire Talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Hi, Kelly. Why don't you start, why don't you give us a synopsis of maybe let's start in your teenage years and bring us up to where you are today, kind of.
Really?
And 2 minutes left.
Of my life between my teen years and now I'm 43?
Yeah,
okay,
why don't
you
just bring us through the good parts of your life, honey.
All right, so I actually grew up in Hartford, Wisconsin, very small. It's actually a little bit bigger now, but I have to say Hartford, Wisconsin, you know, population 412, if you count cows as equal to people, which if you live in Hartford, Wisconsin, you do. And that's where I grew up till I was 12. When I was 12, my dad died, and my mom met us at the end of the driveway. We had like a almost a mile-long driveway in the station wagon, all packed up. We were coming home from school. It was like after, this was after 4 weekends of being snowed in with two preteen kids. And my mom was like, "We're moving to Florida," so we just moved to Florida. And she also put us in. Yeah, she also put us in. Up until that time, we had always gone to public school, and she put my sister and I in a Christian school, Warner Christian Academy, which in my work I usually refer to as Podunk Christian Academy, until I got this nasty email from one of the teachers who's still there, who apparently spends his time Googling former students late at night. And he was like, "I can't believe you called us Podunk Christian Academy in your website." And I was like, "Well, maybe I, you know," and I did it actually out of like, you know, sympathy for them, maybe not wanting the first hit on Warner Christian Academy to come up with like a big old dyke, you know, stand-up comedy. So, I think a lot of the reason for my mom putting us in that school, and she actually really sacrificed to have us there, was she really saw me coming as a, you know, my actual name is Kelly Sue. It's not Kelly, it's Kelly Sue, and which is proof positive if you go far enough into the Midwest or actually in the South. And so I didn't like the name Kelly Sue, and so I started insisting that my relatives call me Kelly Sam. And then they mysteriously dropped the Sue part and were just content with calling me Sue. So I think my mom was really, you know, kind of afraid of my burgeoning, not even really my sexual orientation, but my gender identity. And she was really scared. I mean, there was an actual rule at Warner Christian Academy that girls should not wear flannel shirts. That was an actual rule, you know. Like, wow, that's a very specific anti-lesbian rule. You know, they might as well made it against Birkenstocks and eating hummus and potluck. So even though that was in some ways a really restrictive environment, and I think especially my gender identity I really struggled with, the upside was they're very small classes, and I'm the youngest, actually, of 7 kids, you know, so it was at the very end, and my mom was really kind of done with parenting by the time she had her 7th kid, and so there was, you know, we had really small classes, and these teachers who were very involved in their students' lives, and it actually, even though it would seem like, oh, like, a, you know, Baby Dyke is a small Christian school, a great place for them, but actually it was. It was a really, ended up being a really good place for me, and there's a lot of people who really cared about me and made me feel important and talented, and that was, so even though it was very, you know, and difficult in some ways, not as difficult in others, when I graduated from Podunk Christian Academy, I would say I went to Podunk Bible College. I went to Mid-America Bible College in Oklahoma City, where there were rules against, for example, haircuts not in keeping with Christian faith and doctrine. You know, I don't know exactly what kind of haircut that would be, but what I showed up with was not a haircut consistent with you know, Christian faith and doctrine. I think whatever haircut it would have been, it would have not been okay. I actually spent three semesters there, and then I actually moved to Haiti where I worked. That was like in 1989, and I worked in Haiti, and I was working at a school for kids with disabilities, and that was in the middle of almost a civil war. And so the school closed down because a bomb exploded very close to the school. And so I was like in Haiti but had no work, you know, during the middle of a civil war. So I was sitting at breakfast one day, and this American dentist came, and he said, "Hey, Kelly, I'm going to the Home for the Dying. Do you want to come?" And I was like, Home for the Dying? Like, who would want to go to the Home for the Dying? But I was still enough of an adolescent to turn it kind of into a challenge and say yes for the sake of kind of the, you know, of pride. And I showed up there, and that's actually where that convent was run by the Missionaries of Charity, and that's how I met the Missionaries of Charity. I spent 5 years volunteering with them full-time, and I became a nun for 2 years, which is kind of not a very, I have to say, like, I'm glad I tried, but it didn't end up being a satisfying experience for them. And then after that time, went to nursing school, left the convent, started my life over, went to nursing school. And pretty shortly after I graduated from nursing school, I started both doing nursing and I started stand-up comedy. So, and that kind of takes me up to the present day. That's basically more or less what I've been doing in all sorts of different fashions and stuff.
Well, that's the normal logical path that most people would take, so nothing interesting there at all.
I just wanted to get into part. What was inside you that made you want to go to Haiti to help? Because there's no reason to go to Haiti unless you're going to help. So what made you want to help the people of Haiti?
Well, I mean, to back up a little bit, I mean, there are people, I mean,
sure.
Up until the AIDS crisis, there was actually a Club Med in Haiti. I mean, Haiti, there are parts of Haiti that are absolutely beautiful. I mean, that always gets, I mean, absolutely, and especially as we see now, but just to clarify, that Haiti does have, but of course, that's true. I was not going for the beaches. Yes, you're absolutely right about that. You know, it's kind of interesting because when I was in high school, one of the things that we did was we had, like, we called it, quote-unquote, a missions trip. And we went to these tiny little islands of St. Kitts and Nevis. They're in the Caribbean. And even though St. Kitts and Nevis, certainly by most developing country standards, have a lot going on, but they still have, you know, like problems with hunger and preventable disease and that kind of thing. And that was kind of my first experience seeing the kind of, I mean, because there's poverty and then there's desperation, right? And that was my first experience really getting that perspective of, even though there were some things that were really difficult about my childhood, still, in global terms, I'd won the lottery. And I think that was my first kind of experience of that. And I remember reading, and I don't know whose quote this is. These are not my words, but I should probably Google it. But the quote of somebody is saying, like, you know, service is the rent you pay for your place on earth. And I just felt like, wow, like, look at how much that I've received. There's something I need to do to kind of, like, you know, but you don't receive this much and not give back or provide service in some real substantial way, you know.
Very good. Yeah. I you know, just when you said that, a smile came across my face. You're absolutely right. Without knowing you prior to these few minutes we've been speaking, I can tell already you are a woman with a compassionate heart, because those words don't come out of anyone that does not have compassion. So for that, I thank you.
Oh.
So go ahead.
Well, there was a child in Haiti, wasn't there, that really caught your heart?
Are you talking specifically of the most recent trip, or when I first went there?
Was there something about scars?
Oh, you know, that was actually interestingly enough, my most recent trip right after the earthquake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can certainly tell that story. I mean, the earthquake was actually, you know, after I left Haiti, I worked with Haitian refugees in Miami, and I had intermittently had some interactions with the Haitian community, both in Miami and in New York. But up until actually the earthquake, I mean, and that was for years, but up until after the earthquake, I hadn't really had a lot of ongoing experience with Haiti. And but as soon as the earthquake happened, and my girlfriend, she said, she had her first, you know, she was watching it on TV or probably online, and she said her first, you know, impulse was like, oh, my God, that's terrible. And then her second thought was, oh, my God, I know Kelly's going to want to go. So I did, and it was not, you know, I mean, everything was in such chaos and not a lot of infrastructure to start out with, and such chaos and trying to get people in. And, you know, I signed up with a bunch of different organizations and everyone was trying to get people in. And I was like, finally, I have a friend who's a nurse practitioner there. And he said, Kelly, if you just get here, I will find you a place to work. So I actually flew into the Dominican Republic because commercial planes were not going to Haiti. And I had absolutely no plan much beyond that. I somehow had to get from the Dominican Republic to Port-au-Prince. So basically I found Haitian American college kids who were kind of enamored with the idea of a white person speaking Creole, or like at least enamored of it enough to let me tag along with them. And so I essentially No, it was a step above hitchhiking, but I basically hitchhiked to Port-au-Prince. And then my friend just took me around to the different relief organizations that were doing work there and said, hey, Creole-speaking nurse, Creole-speaking nurse. Anyone need a Creole-speaking nurse? And I feel like I ended up in a very lucky situation. Very small organization that had been in Haiti for a long time. Real collaborative effort between Haitians and expats. And they were running a boys' home at the time. And, they just realized, well, I think we need to run a hospital now. So it was really, I call it a field hospital, but it was really a porch. You know, it's just a porch with a bunch of injured people on it. And there was a kid there he had been really injured. And he was one of those kids that I can't use the expression, c'est lui-même qui était sauvé, like they were the only one who was saved. And often people would tell that story about kids, like that there would just be, you know, an entire house would collapse and only one small child would be pulled out of the wreckage alive. And there, you know, I don't know like the science, what the science is behind it, but my guess is, A, children are smaller, so they have, less body mass to get hit by falling things. And so they can exist in smaller pockets of air, whatever. And then also I think, like, when I would talk with kids about it, they almost always have snacks near them, you know? So they always had, like, some kind of little snack to get them through. Anyway, so this kid was stuck, and everyone was killed, and all his close family members were killed in the earthquake. And, you know, his three sisters and his mom and his dad, and I think his grandpa, but his grandma was still alive. And he was, you know, very severely injured. And I have some scars on my arm from different things when I was younger, and just through a long series of process of getting to know him and stuff. And at one point, he rubbed his hand, you know, severely injured kid, this kid who almost died, and he rubbed his hand along the scars on my arm, and he was like, you know, all our scars are the same. And I was like, wow. I mean, it was like such a generous act for this seven-year-old kid to be, you know, equating these kind of minor scars that I had with just his, like, you know, just unbelievably traumatic experience. I mean, traumatic in a way that none of us could even imagine. So, it was such an act of solidarity, and it was so profound for a kid, you know.
Yeah, you know, when you think of a seven-year-old child, you think of them playing in the backyard with green grass on the ground, you know?
Right.
You don't think of them living in those kind of conditions, and to have that kind of understanding to a full-grown adult of a different color from a different race in their land. I mean, that's a totally different subject, but I am glad you brought that up. So it sounds to me like you go back to Haiti more than once. So how many times have you been to Haiti?
I lived there initially in 1989 for 3 or 4 months, and that was just kind of an initial just getting to know. And then I lived there, no, that was 1988, and then I was from 1989 to 1992-ish, around 3 years.
Wow.
And then I went back, you know, I've been back at various other times. And then immediately after the earthquake, I was back for a month afterwards, so...
Okay. After working for the Mission of Charities, which we all have a different idea on who they are. What did you do after that? Where did you go when you came back? I mean, what was going on in your life at that time? Because at this time you're not a comedian yet, although your life is comedian, but you have not become to the stage yet. So, what did you do when you got done with your compassion work? I want to call it. Well, I guess you're never really done with that work, but when you got done helping in Haiti,
I was actually, after I left the convent, I was, that the training part of the convent, although I volunteered with them in Haiti and in Pennsylvania, the actual training part, all the North American women who become missionaries of charity are required to go to a house actually in the Bronx. And so the day that I left, my mistress, my aspiring mistress, Sister Angeles, you know, took me to Port Authority, and she's standing there tapping her little nun foot going, well, where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? You know? And so I was like, you know, I had like 5 minutes to decide, and I was like, well, I know I want to go to a big city, and I should probably go where I know someone. My sister was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I also knew that I needed to go back to school. So that was kind of my decision. So once I moved to Philadelphia and, you know, kind of restarted my life and, you know, got an apartment. And then I went back to nursing. I went to nursing school. And after that, I don't think I actually started comedy while I was still in nursing school, but shortly after I graduated. So I started both new careers about at the same time. And originally, my first nursing job, I worked as the primary care RN at a nurse-run health center in North Philadelphia, and it was very, very grassroots as well. I mean, we didn't even have a phone book when we started. It was that grassroots, and we were just moved into a community building in one of the housing projects in North Philadelphia and just started providing public health, and then eventually started providing primary health as well. And then about that time, I started I always wanted to be a stand-up comic when I was a little kid. We had, you know, I mentioned the, you know, almost mile-long driveway, and there were our neighbors had beef cows. And so all the way in on the first part of the driveway, there's, you know, always the beef cow standing there, and I would always stop and, you know, try and tell them jokes. And they were a little bit of a hard audience, I have to say. But ever since I was little, I always wanted to be a stand-up comic. And about the time I graduated from nursing school was also about the time that I was turning 30. And I was like, you know what, I'm not going to be any more ready to be a stand-up comic until when I'm 50. So I was like, this is really the time that I need to do it. And originally I started kind of the way most people start, which is open mics in regular comedy clubs, you know, like whatever comedy club is in your town, like, you know. And I really I really struggled with that for a while. And because there's so much misogyny, so much homophobia, and so much racism in kind of mainstream stand-up comedy. It's really, it's definitely kind of answers to the lowest common denominator of humor often. So I had this experience where I had this gig at a stand-up comedy club in Northeast Philadelphia, and I used to start my set with, okay, I need you to ignore all the physical cues and believe that and believe me when I tell you that I'm an adult female and not a 12-year-old boy. And so some guy yelled from the audience, "You're not a 12-year-old boy. You're a big, fat, ugly dyke." And just without even thinking, my response was, "Oh, you know," and it didn't even stop at my brain, you know, at the, like, you know, before it came out of my mouth. I just said, "Oh, you're just sad I'm not a 12-year-old boy. You and the Catholic creep." So.
I love it.
But it was a little rougher than I usually – that's much rougher than I usually am. I'm very usually nice with
you. Yeah.
And but it really angered him, and he actually chased me in the parking lot after the gig with a broken bottle. And as I was running away from the drunk guy with a broken bottle, I thought, you know, I either need to get better at running, like I need to either increase my running speed, or I need to find alternative venues. And I figured that at 30, probably alternative venues would be easier than, you know, taking up sprinting, you know, competitive sprinting. So that actually is that was really one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I said, okay, like, what can I model my stand-up comedy career on that's not these, you know, these comedy clubs where everyone's just answering to the lowest common denominator? So what I did is I just modeled my comedy career on my indie musician friends who, you know, would put out a CD every couple of years and would just tour around different places, book themselves in alternative venues. And so that's when I started doing. And that has been, I mean, I was able to go to it much more full-time, much more quickly than friends who were working in comedy clubs. And I didn't have to perform with people that I was embarrassed to perform with. You know, I pick who I perform with. When you perform at a comedy club, you can. And, you know, I remember one time saying to the booker, like, I am not going to, this guy was crazy and bananas. And I said, I'm not going to perform with a white person who used the N-word. And she was like, well, you're not in a position where you can you know, where you can determine that yet. You're not that far. And I was like, oh, yes, I can. Because I was like, what am I going to do? Send out, like, have two separate mailing lists, one for my racist fans, you know? So that has really enabled, I mean, and I've had so much fun with it in a way that I feel like other people who have tried to do just the kind of touring around to, you know, the small town in Alabama that has a comedy club and then the small town in Mississippi that has a comedy club, where I'm really performing for people who want to see specifically me. And that has been such a gift. It's completely different. It's completely different, you know, as a performer.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. What I heard you say in that segment is, once again, have you noticed, Kelly, that you have put yourself into career paths in your life that all seem to cater to the compassionate people? From your nun with Mission to Charities to going to nursing school, now to go into laughter. I mean, it's they're all healing attributes. I find that pretty amazing that someone who has gone through what you've explained to us continues to want to reach out and nurture. And I just think that's a great thing inside you. It's part of your spirit, and that's what makes you who you are today.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a natural. I mean, sometimes when people are like, wait, now how is that a career path? Like starting as a nun, being a nurse, like are you a nurse? Are you a stand-up comic? Which one are you? And I feel like they're both. I mean, I feel like both. I love being a nurse. I'm so proud of being a nurse. I think nursing is it's an amazing profession. Most, not all, but most nurses I know are amazing. And, certainly I get very ashamed of sometimes what stand-up comedy makes, but some of the really good comedic performers that I know I believe that laughter is a revolutionary gesture, you know, and it's really, there's all sorts of ways that people can laugh about things before they can ever have a serious conversation about them. So I think that there's so much potential in, I've definitely seen in my own life where, I mean, I remember in my little house in Haiti, I had a little sign up that says, well, if you're going to laugh about it in 5 years, you know, if it's going to be funny in 5 years, you might as well laugh about it now. So myself, you know.
Great attitude, yeah.
Yeah. I had two partners who passed away from cancer in the last 5 years, and I do a lot of gallows humor with it. I mean, it's just my way of dealing. When people get kind of uncomfortable, I'll be like, this is kind of my one coping mechanism, so you don't really want to mess with it, you know.
Yeah, really.
Right? Right.
You're absolutely right. Don't reach in and mess with the mechanism that keeps me moving.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's an amazing observation I've made. I've met many preachers who love to hear themselves talk. And just for the hell of it, I'd go into a church with probably two or three people sitting in the pew, and the preacher giving the oratory of his life because he loves to hear himself talk. It's easy to be a preacher because essentially they're captive audiences. What I've noticed about you is that you are so spontaneous and you are so free, Kelly. You have such a beautiful spirit, and I appreciate the fact that you, with all the stuff you've been through in your life, you have the courage to take a rather daunting career, because stand-up comedy, in my observation, is probably the most difficult art in the entertainment business. And I really respect that. I'm a musician, and I could, you know, I could get away with what I do in most venues, but once in a while I could get a chuckle. But to be a stand-up comic, it's something that getting that laughter, getting that laugh, getting that response or that reaction is a demand in a profession like you've chosen. I am so, so damn proud of you, Kelly. And I'm glad you're on today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, stand-up comedy, I mean, so difficult as far as in the entertainment business. And, you know, and sometimes when I'm feeling sorry for myself, I'll say, like, Kelly, do you work in a mine? No? Okay, then. You know, like, how bad can it really be?
I don't know. I would have to think, I know this comes from a desire inside you, and it's your passion, and you're following it, or you wouldn't be doing it, but... Were you scared shitless the first time you stood up to a mic?
Yeah.
Let's see.
You know, because I got a big mouth, and I can yell across the room, and I don't care who looks at me when I yell it. But to put me in front of a mic when they're staring at me, that's a totally different story, you know?
You know, I don't ever remember feeling like, I mean, there are different situations. I don't think the first time I didn't know enough to be scared, you know? I'm your first time, you're like, well, I just got to do this, and it doesn't matter. Certainly I have been in situations where, and now the longer I perform, you know, now I've been doing it almost 9 years, the more I perform, or I should find out when my anniversary is. I think it might even be 10 now. But the more you do it, and also the more unique situations that you're in, you know, like, you know, you just learn, like, how to deal with a, you know, how to deal with a crowd that's not listening to you, how to deal with a crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, I performed, I don't even know why I agreed to do this, perhaps just for the story, but I performed at, it was like a lesbian night at a strip club.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone who was on stage that night, except for me, was taking off their clothes. Like, they actually took the women taking off their clothes off the stage so that I could come on and do jokes. Now, you can imagine how well-received that was. You know,
my
little tip, if you're going to be an entertainer, don't ever be an entertainer where people are taking off their clothes and then, you know, you're the only person who can
stop
them.
That's
a bad idea.
I can't compete. I can't compete.
Yeah, I got nothing. You know, got nothing. I ended up, you know, doing it over. Whatever, I ended up doing an imitation of what it would look like if comics were strippers, you know, which went over okay. I mean, nobody threw anything at me, but the more experiences you have like that, you learn, A, that those are kind of no-win situations, and that the only reason maybe to do something like that is either for the money or just for the experience. But then you also do learn how to handle those situations. I mean, for me, the most difficult situation is probably... It's very difficult if people are very, very drunk. If they're kind of drunk, it's all right. You have to slow down a little bit. But if they are very, very drunk to the point, like I did this gig at a resort. It's a gay resort in the Poconos. And I'm not even going to say the name of it because I love this resort and they're very good to me. But when I perform there, it starts at 11 p.m. and people aren't driving home. You know, it's so they're so drunk. And I can remember, like, having a male heckler who was just like, you know, I'd make a joke and he'd be like, ah! And I was like, that's not even a good heckle. You're actually, you know, that's not a heckle.
Yeah.
And there's just no
you
way
to make a noise.
It. So when people are drinking very heavily, that can be difficult as well. So
But,
you know, like, different things that scare me different times. Also, my first Pride event that I ever did, the co-chair of the Pride committee had been killed the previous day in a car accident. And so as I went on stage, the stage manager grabbed me by the shirt and said, "You've got to make us laugh. All we've done is cry for the last 36 hours. I was like,
no pressure.
Whoa,
there.
That's so fun. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. You're like, alrighty.
Do you perform at a lot of gay prides around, because I, you know, every major city has one around the world. Do you perform at a lot of them, or do you just got booked into a couple of them? Are you on that circuit for gay pride?
I have had years where I was like the wedding singer, only the gay pride, you know, comic that I did. I think the most I ever did, because they tend to all be clumped together in June, although a lot of the southern prides are going to October festivities, you know, because it's just so, I remember doing Atlanta Pride, which used to be in July and now is in September.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, with global warming, couldn't we really be just as proud in October? But I've had years where I've done as many as 32 prides in, like, you know, a month and a half.
Very good.
So.
Very good. I work with the Pride Board here in Las Vegas. You know, what prides do is they raise money for education in their communities. They're not an organization. Well, I'm sure you know this before, listeners. Pride, what they do is they raise money in the community. But they're not an organization that holds on to their money. They actually distribute their money to other nonprofits in the community that helps the LGBT community, let's say, like, for HIV and for rental assistance and things like that. So it's actually the heartbeat of a community. And most what prides do is they help support their gay and lesbian centers of their area. You know, that's the heartbeat of the gay and lesbian community throughout the cities across this world. So we have a deal with Pride right now. I'm bringing in 16 of my bartenders to bartend, and what the Pride here does is they donate that $10 an hour for every volunteer hour to a nonprofit. So what we've done something pretty unique here in Las Vegas this year is we're bringing that money is leaving Las Vegas, yet still helping people. It's heading towards Pine Ridge to buy propane this winter for the natives who live on Pine Ridge. for the propane. So Pride is at least here in Vegas is branching out, and they're very, very good organizations. They're ran by professional people who simply give them time to make money. So Pride festivals are a very good thing to sponsor and to be part of. So I'm very happy to hear that you are part of those organizations around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I really love the kind of, you know, like performing at Mid-South Pride, which is actually ends up being, it's in Memphis, Tennessee, but it ends up being a Mississippi Pride because a lot of the people, there's only one, I think, one major Pride event in Mississippi, and a lot of people who are like teachers or whatever don't feel like they can be out enough to go to that Pride, so they come to Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And,
standing
on stage, I came off stage in this this person hugged me and said, you know, I was a person who's transgender and just started living as a woman. And she said, just looking at you and seeing how happy you are in your life and your body just gives me the courage to go home and live for the next year. You know, and that's like, I mean, that's so humbling. Like,
that's what
I just stood on the stage.
Why
I just stood on the stage and told some jokes. But, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, people sometimes in big cities are like, oh, I'm so bored by Pride. I'm so over it. I'm so post-queer. And I'm like, no, we have not even, I mean, I performed at La Crosse, Wisconsin Pride, and even just kind of the experiences I met there, I mean, people are who are still where I came from, you know, and are really struggling to be out, and is it safe? And,
right.
And, I mean, there's so much more work to be done. I mean, the idea that, I feel like the gay community has so much to give, and we have given so much over the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be part of a larger social justice movement, I think is key and really important, you know. So.
Well, so, you know, I truly believe it is an untapped market. There is a lot of expendable cash in the gay community. And it just seems to me that with removing discriminations and racism and prejudice would be a market to reach in. And I'm going to tell you, here in Las Vegas, the hotels have done just that. The Las Vegas Visitor Authority just came up with Gay Vegas. They are actually promoting the gay lifestyle in Vegas. Now, when I say lifestyle, I don't want it to sound like you've had a choice in this matter, because I don't believe that's what gay and lesbian is. I believe that you're born with who you are. It has nothing to do with where you live or the environment you live in. You're either heterosexual, you're bisexual, or you're gay or you're lesbian. So, I mean, this whole concept of we can heal you, it's like so farce that if that would simply lead people's minds of trying to change who they are and actually embrace them for who they are, I think we would live in a hell of a lot better world than we do today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what? I'm going to play a copy of this show for a right-wing evangelical church I know very well and do not like. Thank you.
Oh, you're so funny. But maybe you can come to Vegas.
I would love to come to Vegas. I mean, I love doing Pride events. I really do. I mean, and some comics don't because they're often outdoors and you're kind of having to scream and people are, walking past you and not very interested in what you have to say because they're cruising each other. But I love gay Pride events. I have a great time.
You have to come in as the headliner so that you're at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, even when I have a bad time at a Pride, I have a good time. So.
Yeah. Yeah, those festivals are just an amazing thing. It's an array of people, families,
mm-hmm.
children, who come together for one thing, to give support and to raise money. And I don't care what color you are or what you want to close the door with behind you. That doesn't matter to me when people come together for that reason, to help other people, you know?
Yeah.
So, you're in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You're a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Are you booking every week? I mean, what's going on with you? Where are you going? Where are you heading? What you got happening
right.
in New York right now?
Well, right now I'm booked I took, my partner was very ill. She passed away June 18th, and I actually took off some months from traveling. I mean, I did some gigs, but I didn't travel as much while she was ill. And so I just actually kind of started with my college agent. And my colleges, I have an agency that does that for me, which is, colleges I actually really love. I mean, that is really, like, you know, you get picked up by some kid who's like, let me tell you about my hopes and dreams. And you get to hear, you know, some 18-year-old talk about their hopes and dreams. And then you go perform, and then you do a workshop, and then you get to hear another 18-year-old talk about their hopes and dreams. And I find it just really... it's one of my favorite things to do is colleges. But so I have an agency that actually books colleges for me because it's its own kind of special market and they have specialized knowledge and all. I do a lot at colleges, actually. I do often, they bring me in as kind of the funny nurse, which I do a presentation called Fuck Your Health, which is about basically, you know, the LGBT community, we really have to fight. I mean, people have been so discriminated against traditionally in healthcare, and often, not often, but many times people are not maybe as comfortable with their body, maybe like they have some gender stuff going on. And so folks let things go. They don't get preventative care or it's not available to them. So a lot of what I do is comedy about healthcare and kind of encouraging people to get healthcare. And then often, like, for example, I went to Colorado State in May. In March, and I did a night show that was called Fuck Your Health, and bless their hearts, that's how they advertised it, because I have an alternative name, which is Queer Bodies, Queer Selves. And I certainly understand if people use Queer Bodies, Queer Selves, but I feel like, especially with young people, like to just kind of shock them a little bit and be like, no, your health is super important. We need to talk about it. So I did an evening show, and because the name of the show was Fuck Your Health, and because they did a tremendous job at advertising it, it wasn't just the gay kids that came. Like, 300 kids came. It was amazing on a weekend night. And listened to me talk about funny stuff about health and why, you know, basically why it's really important to get preventative care and why you need to fight for, you need to actually fight for your health care, you know. And then I often do, like I did a workshop for the healthcare system for their LGBT employees. Talking about how to basically, you know, how to work with LGBT people in the healthcare system, but also how to be an ally. And so not just LGBT employees that came, also allies came as well. So that's kind of the things I do at colleges often. And sometimes I just do a regular hour gig at night, which is really fun as well. And I do storytelling workshops as well. So coming up, I'm trying to think of this Saturday in New York, I do something called Queer Memoir, and I'm actually a co-producer of that and the co-founder, and that is an LGBT storytelling event. And it is amazing. I have to say, like, you know, one of the things about queer organizing is you just do whatever you can do because you just create something because you're like, oh, I wish there was a queer storytelling event. And you're like, well, there will be if you make one, you know. So it was just like, right, kind of throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. And Queer Memoir, from the moment we started it, like a year and a half ago, people have just been so hungry for it. And the amazing thing is it brings people from together from all different areas of the community. And they, it's, you know, it's booked. It's not just anyone gets up and gets to tell the story, but we really encourage people, myself and my co-producer, Jenny Murphy, playwright from Philadelphia. We work with people to help them learn how to put together their story and tell it publicly. So that's
awesome.
We've been taking a little hiatus while my partner's ill, but we're doing that again on September 10th in New York. And then a big event I have it coming up in New York is October 1st. I'll be doing my completely new stand-up comedy show with all new material called Why is the Fat One Always Angry? and that's kind of a celebration of, I call it, it's my I'm Still Funny, Damn It, 43rd birthday show. The Why is the Fat When I Was Angry, my partner actually made up the name of that CD because we were we're really quite a mix. She is a child of Italian American and Irish American parents in New York, very, very East Coast, grew up on Staten Island. And I am a Midwesterner, you know, and the two of us, you know, she always wears all black and big sunglasses, and I have this, you know, kind of chubby Midwestern smiley face. And so when we would interact with the healthcare system, of the two of us, it would look like she would be the one that, you know, would have to be really holding people's feet to the fire. But because I'm a nurse and because she was ill, you know, I was always the one who was like, no, you have to do this, you know, because the thing is, you know, no one should ever go to the hospital alone. No one ever, 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 ever. Not because people aren't trying to give you good health care there, but because the American healthcare system is completely broken. And so Cheryl was saying that, you know, my partner was saying that, like, as we would walk away, they would all, the, you know, whatever healthcare person would be like, why is the fat one always angry? So that's how we came up with the name of the CD. And I actually spent my 43rd birthday was in July, and I was trying to carry an air conditioner down four flights of stairs and tripped over, as my friend said, my big butch ego, and dropped it on my hand. And so I spent my 43rd birthday in the medical ER of Bellevue Hospital. So I was like, I think I want to do that over and have a big show where everyone comes. So that's what I'm doing October 1st at the Stonewall. I have other things coming up. I'm recording my third CD in San Francisco December 10th. And it's going to be called Why It's Fat When I Was Angry. I'm recording that at
The
Dark Room on Mission Street in San Francisco. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then, you know, different stuff. I think I'm booked almost every weekend this fall, different places.
You know, I love that. And I... The humor that comes out of the gay community is just friggin' hysterical. And the story behind how you came up with the name, why is the fat when I was angry, makes it even that much more funnier. I wish you great success on that. I do know you're also the author of four books already, correct?
That's true, yeah.
You wrote Squeaky Clean. Well, hold on. Let me see. Where am I at here on your thing? You wrote How to Survive and Maybe Even Love Nursing School.
Yep.
You wrote How to Survive and, I just read that one. The Boy's Body Book, Everything You Needed to Know for Growing Up You. That's a great title, for Growing Up You. The Girl's Body Book, Everything You Need to Know About for Growing Up You. Awesome. I mean, you have been busy, it seems, your entire life.
Yeah, well. I was actually saying this to my, you know that Twitter feed shit my dad says? I think I'm going to start a Twitter feed shit my therapist says. Because the other day I said to my therapist, well, you know, I just got to keep moving. You know, hard work is therapy. And she looked at me for a minute and she said, well, okay, Kelly, but really therapy is therapy. But for me, you know, hard work is therapy. So I have been busy. But yeah, the How to Survive and Maybe Even Love Nursing School, a very verbose title, did not come up with that, but the publisher came up with it. But that actually I wrote when I was in nursing school, and I interviewed over 500 nursing students and educators. It's a real nitty-gritty, like, grassroots, like, how to survive nursing school, like, everything from, like, how to take notes in class to how to deal with bad smells when you're on the clinical floor, you know.
So what you did was you broke it down for them.
and
you broke it down and made it simplified.
It's a funny book. It's illustrated with cartoons, and the people who published it are F.A. Davis, where they're best known for Tabor's Medical Dictionary. I mean, these are not people who usually, in fact, there are many words that are in my book that we actually had to put into the F.A. Davis style directory because they were not there before. You know, they are not used to, when I go to their offices, it's like, one of these things is not like the other. But they have been excellent to me. And actually, it got adopted as a text for a lot of beginning nursing classes. And, you know, I have a Google Alert on my name. When I find that somebody is using my book and there's, you know, it comes up like, read chapter 2 of Dunham, like in their syllabus, I think like, oh no, it's not that kind of book, you know. But that's really, and it's also become popular for, because the nursing shortage is partly caused by the nursing instructor shortage. And so there's like these long waiting periods of time to get into nursing school. Even people have been accepted, and so they started teaching nursing school success classes to pre-nursing students, and it's also being used there. So that's been, I mean, I feel really grateful that I was able to write that book and that it's done really as well as it has. It's done really tremendously well for such a niche book. And then I also co-wrote a book called How to Survive and Maybe Even Love Life as a Nurse, which is a follow-up mm-hmm. to that. And then, also by F.A. Davis. And then the other two books are kids, well, they're preteen books, and they're published by Applesauce Press, which is an imprint of, I should know this, but I've forgotten. I believe. And I've only ever worked with imprint people. And that was actually really interesting because they're also funny books. You know, they're illustrated by Lori Talhardy. So they have, like, cartoons in them and such. And they are made specifically, the target range is 8 to 12. But they're specifically created so that you can give them to a kid as young as they start asking because they stop just short of actually talking about sex. Boys' book talks about wet dreams and it talks about masturbation, but it doesn't actually talk about sex so that you can give it to, if your 7-year-old asks you about it, you can give it to your 7-year-old without fear that they're going to go to school with more knowledge than the other kids at school have and share that knowledge.
Right.
So the boys' book especially has done really, really well. And strangely enough, both the boys' book and the girls' book have been adopted for use by the Sunlight, S-O-N, Light Christian homeschooling curriculum, which is like probably the most conservative homeschooling curriculum out there.
Holy cow.
So, and how I found out about that is one of the Christian school or the homeschool moms actually was complaining about the book on Amazon. And I was like, it's just hilarious the thing she was complaining about because I'm like, this book was written by a big old dyke and it says like, oh, people are lots of different genders and there's all sorts of ways that look like family. But what the person was complaining about is that I said that, you know, if you're mad sometimes you can, you know, like scream into a pillow. And they're like, we don't want our children screaming into pillows. That was what they really, that's what they really.
That was their big divining factor there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was her whole problem.
And I actually had
I actually had
a great experience where, I mean, and you never have an experience like this with kids' books, certainly, where I was at a speaking engagement in Brooklyn, and I had, you know, I was, we were telling, it was at a high school, and we were talking about different careers. Like, basically, they're bringing in gay people and being like, look, gay people do all sorts of different things for a living. And I was talking about my books, and one of the other people participating was like, oh, I have an 8-year-old boy. Can I please buy that book from you? So she bought it. And like a week later, I ran into him and his mom at a party. And he told, you know, he fist bumped me and he was like, dude, that was a good book. I wasn't even embarrassed. And I was like, whoa, that, like, you know, as a children's book author, you never, especially about, you know, body issues, like you never get that kind of feedback. So I felt very lucky to have that kind of feedback from that kid. So.
Yeah, you know, I feel what you've done, and this is just my feeling, I feel what you've done is you've taken an awkward situation of an awkward period of your life, and you have given a little humor to it with a lot of truth and education, and that's where your success came from.
Yeah.
I wish you continue that success. You seem to, I don't know if you know that you're doing it, but whatever you're doing, you seem to put your things in place correctly, and things happen for you. I wish you luck in continuing putting those things in place. You seem to have lived a very colorful life that has brought you through across many barriers in different avenues that people would never even touched on. I mean, growing up, I was thinking I'm going to work in the steel mills like my parents did, you know? I'm going to have a house like this someday. I mean, I didn't stop to think about the things that you have expressed that you've traveled through in your life, and it's just everyone's life is an amazing story, and yours I feel a lot of positive from. I don't know your personal background, but I feel a lot of positive from you, and working in a community of charity and volunteerism, I can only imagine that it wasn't always like that, and I commend you for who you are today. Very good at who you are.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's amazing that how much compassion you've shown for children in so many different ways, and yet society is afraid of you and you having children and being around children. And it's insane because you are an extremely compassionate person who has done way more for children than they ever will do in their life.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a funny thing about, you know, people, like, you know, for years, like, the idea of, like, oh, gays getting married, that's not really my fight. I mean, I feel like, you know, gay people want to get married, more power to them. That's not what I'm looking for in my life. I mean, but we do need those rights, but I'm not, you know, so much gay marriage is not my thing. But, you know, when they talk about, like, oh, gays are going to be raising children, I'm like, we have been raising children for forever.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, if they let us...
You know, I've got news for them. I got news for them. Homosexuals don't produce children. Heterosexuals do. You know, so you're absolutely right. We have been raising children. You've been raising us. You've been raising gays and lesbians and transgenders. We're your children. You know what I'm saying? So that whole concept makes no sense to me. You know, all of a sudden, because you're an adult now and you have a sexual identity, you're no longer human. You know, it's that whole concept, I'm with you. It's just ridiculous. And I think the way to get over it is exactly what you've done. You've risen above it.
Yeah.
And that's how you get over ignorance. You rise above ignorance. So continue doing that, sister.
All right.
Good job so far. You've done a lot of help for a lot of people. You bring laughter to them, which I'm going to tell you, without laughter, there is no life left. You know, so you continue to be a life source.
And definitely we're here for you in anything you want to put out as far as your new material or anything else. Just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to get you on the air.
Okay. All right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you
so much. Thank you so much.
Well, Kyle, it was an honor talking with you today. I'm very humbled from what I heard from you. You know, we're going to quit complimenting you here now, okay? But, you know, we deal with so many different types of subject that this is a very light show, and I embrace it, you know, and I embrace you, and your humor is astounding. It stands out. It marks who you are, and for that, I want to tell you, you keep doing what you're doing. You're helping people out there, and that's what matters. Continue helping people.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining us, and come back anytime.
All right. Thank you. Take care now.
Bye-bye. Pretty positive show today. Now, thank you so much for bringing Kelly to us and bringing her story to air. And we're going to keep an eye on Kelly. Kelly seems like a very positive person who's got her head on straight and knows what it takes to get people what they need. And sometimes that's just a little compassion or sometimes a little understanding. So once again, thanks. You guys want to end with something? Or
I
want to
end with
the show?
David, did you have anything to say before we end it?
Well, there is one thing. It's a friendly word of advice to our fellow human beings out there. Ugliness or hatred blinds us to the beauty of humanity. We do have ugly human beings out there who do a lot of bad, evil things, and they destroy whatever's in their path. Balance is not a matter of black and white. The beauty of humanity is what we need to see. Today we had a beautiful human being on the show. So my advice to all my friends out there listening to the show, get past your prejudices and your biases and look at the beauty of humanity, because it's out there. Thank you.
Good work. Really
win. Thank you.
All right.
Now take us home. We'll see you all next week on Fire Talk Productions. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Bookshop.
Made a wrong turn once or twice. Dug my way out, blood and fire. Bad decision, that's alright. Welcome to my silly life. Mistreated, please.
try, but we try too hard. A waste of my time, done looking for the critics, cause they're everywhere. They don't like my jeans, they don't get my hair. Change ourselves, and we do it all the time. Why do we do that? Why do I do that? Why do I do that? Yeah!